This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, we're consumed every day for the past few months with domestic problems, flu, COVID, the economic fallout from the war in Ukraine, many things to worry about, mostly people's inability to earn as much as they need. Nurses in particular, crisis in the health service here and in Britain and across Europe, a general feeling that people are afraid, either economically or medically. And in all of that, a much larger danger looms, and it is as a result of Putin's invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February 2022. It was expected to be short and sharp. It's still existing and indeed escalating. And where do we go from here? And where does the world go from here? Because this is a geopolitical problem. It's a moment, a defining moment for the future, I think, of the world we're inhabiting. And it's a pleasure to welcome to the program now John Kampfner. John is one of the most distinguished British journalists and authors. He is now executive director at Chatham House, which is a leading British, well, independent policy institute, it says, which is a think tank, really, I think. And his particular concern is where Europe might go from here, because as we saw in the United States last week, instability is built in there to that society, that powerful country. And across Europe, there are differences of opinion. John, thank you very much for joining us. As I said in my introduction, we tend to be, for obvious reasons and necessary reasons, consumed by the crisis in the health service and fears about employment and inflation. But this moment, when you take into account Russia, China, Taiwan, Ukraine, and the instability, should we call it, in the US, and the growing sense of isolationism, would you agree with me that this is a defining moment for the world for perhaps several decades to come?
Well, good morning, Eamon. Nice to be back. Happy New Year to you and your listeners. Yes, on this very morning, actually, a few hours ago, I was reading in the Financial Times a news piece quoting a report from an American institute, the Atlantic Council. And oh my God, if something is designed to put you off your breakfast, it is this. It was saying nearly half of top foreign policy experts think that Russia will become a failed state or will break up by 2033 in 10 years' time, while a large majority expect China to try to take Taiwan by force. And it goes on by saying other countries will get their own nuclear arsenal. And it is a picture of inherent instability. And I think that's, I mean, I don't know about the specific details. And with China and Taiwan, it could happen any time, but again, it might not. And you have Bolsonaro inciting his people to storm the whole parliamentary complex in Brasilia yesterday. the exact mirror of what happened a couple of years ago with Donald Trump at the US Congress at Capitol Hill. The task for people generally, citizens, and for their governments is just to assume, just to build in this instability, this potential for mayhem into the way we lead our lives. And that's a kind of depressing thought, but nothing beats, you know, you should always expect the worst and hope for the best. And I think this decade coming up, the 20s that we're now into its third year, is just an era that is going to define how we interpret democracy and what we yes. think of the rule of law and issues of war and peace.
Yes, and there seems to be a distinct absence in the West of statesmen, of a figure that can, as it were, rally the various factions. Biden has successfully done it, in my opinion, through NATO in terms of the threat from Putin. But as a piece you wrote that I have in front of me suggests, it's fairly tenuous. Europe isn't really united. And for example, there are differences between France and Germany, traditionally in the last few decades, close allies. There are important differences, though. And there are differences also between the US and Europe as well.
That's right. I mean, Germany had Angela Merkel, and shares in her have been sold since there's been a new way of looking at German relations with Russia. And was she too soft on Putin? That's for another time. And you and I have talked about that before. But she had charisma in her own manner, and she was if not the dominant force in Europe. Her successor, Olaf Scholz, is absolutely not that. He's kept his coalition in Berlin together reasonably well. But on the international stage, he does not cut a figure that you would look at and you think, right, he can help us solve the world's problems. Germany has become quite dangerously, in my view, introspective. Macron in France does have that swagger, and he is now, I would say, the dominant force in the Franco-German relationship. He's developed good relations with Washington and with Biden. Biden, is he going to stand already in his 80s and a man already who looks and sounds frail? But I agree with your analysis, Eamon, that he's done better than he's given credit for
yes.
on the Russia-Ukraine question, holding NATO together, holding the transatlantic alliance together. You look at the sorry state of Britain, and okay, Rishi Sunak is not the clown that was Boris Johnson. He's not the sort of extremist wacko that Liz Truss in her 49 days was, but
44.
He's very much. Say again?
44 days.
Well, it depends how you cut it, actually, whether she announced her resignation or actually the removals van came. But I can't imagine she'd actually unpack many boxes anyway, between the removals van coming to deliver and taking stuff away. But no, she came and went in that sort of volley of madness for which ordinary people are still paying the price. Sunak is much more rational. He's much more pragmatic, but there's just an expectation that the Tories are flailing around and living out their last year or two. And Britain, partly through Brexit and partly through other things, just absolutely has so little clout in the world.
It's fair to say, John, and sorry to interrupt you, that whilst Boris Johnson may be a deeply unlovable person, Boris Johnson led on Ukraine, and Britain backed him when this began. And that was important. And that, if it weren't for all his other faults, he does have the outline of a statesman. And Britain does have in its history a belief in taking the lead and standing up for freedom.
Yeah, you're right to a degree, Eamon. He absolutely was, not just after the 24th of February, but actually in the few months before. He was sounding the alarm,
yes.
notwithstanding Britain's sucking up to the oligarchs for years and decades, including himself before that. No, he did play an important role, and that should be acknowledged. But it is partly his and Britain's sort of Churchill complex and
yes.
the Second World War and the idea that Britain is nothing if it is not leading in some military campaign. And Britain, which is part of my longer thinking with Chatham House, has to develop a new mojo. It has to understand what its role in the world should be as an important middle-ranking power. And it shouldn't regard that as anything ignoble or humiliating. It's an absolutely fine place to be, and it's the place where Britain belongs. I mean, there are a lot of countries now in the world. There's so much fixation on US and China and the mischief maker Russia and on India. But actually, there's a lot of middle-ranking countries that are doing interesting things. If you think of Australia, South Korea, Poland, South Africa, Argentina, Brazil before this mayhem, Mexico, Canada. And that's where Britain belongs, in that sort of rank of second-tier powers. Turkey is the absolute crucial one on that, playing a really important role in Russia and Ukraine, playing an important role in North Africa as well. So Britain does have a future, but it's not the sort of rule Britannia future that it still clings to. But I do wonder, going back to your original question, Eamon, around the quality of leadership. Well, one is obviously the human one, and when people get older, and I'm certainly getting older, well, we all are, and there's that whole sort of question of things were better in my day. I'm not sure there ever was a golden age of, you know, amazing leaders. But then I also think there's this question of the damage that has been done through technology and social media around, there used to be, and some people may say, well, it's a good thing, there used to be a national story, a yes. narrative. In every country in the world, families would sit or huddle around a TV set, or if they didn't have one, a radio, and there would be the news, and there would be the leader, and they would explain what's going on in the world. Now people believe their truth. They believe what they want to believe. So just as Trump's people believe, I think without even doubting themselves, that the presidential election was stolen from them. And the same applies to Bolsonaro's supporters, who believe that a man they regard as a criminal, Lula, has yes. stolen that rightful seat from him. And as long as you have parallel truths, or several parallel truths, I think it's going to be incredibly difficult for any democratic leader to really strike out and be a dominant force. I think it's actually quite easy for demagogues like Trump, yes. like Bolsonaro, like Orban in Hungary, and not to mention Putin and Xi Jinping. But actually, in democracies, that's now going to be incredibly difficult.
Now, your piece about Europe, and just to go back to the leadership thing, it seems to me that if Roosevelt hadn't been there in 1939, if Churchill had not been there at the same time, you wonder what would have happened. But to go back to Europe now, it doesn't have a leader. It doesn't have an Angela Merkel. Now, last week, I think she conceded also that she'd been wrong about China. But she did have the aura, if you like, and the power that Germany has, and she used it. As it happens, history probably won't be very kind to her, will it, John?
I think it will settle in a medium place about her. I'm always been quite positive about her, but in my book, Why the Germans Do It Better, I was singularly critical of German foreign policy and of her, John, and this was 2020, this was before the invasion, some distance. There was a lot of good in German foreign policy, but there was also a refusal to understand that democracy requires hard power to project it and to defend it. And that goes back to the whole German
yes.
Second World War issues, also just a sense of complacency that Russia provides its energy, America supplies its defense, and China provides its markets. And that's all very well when things are going well, but it also felt quite naive. But that said, she was still a dominant force on the world stage, and a force for good on the world stage. And a lot of the good, not least Germany becoming a multicultural state, a much more tolerant country, much more open country, a lot of that is down to her as well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now, in 1952, in the piece you've written for the New European, which is a very interesting piece and a very interesting magazine, you quote the first NATO General Secretary, Lord Eyley, as saying famously that NATO's strategy was to keep the Russians out, to keep the Americans in, and to keep the Germans down.
Yeah.
It is rather funny if you're of a certain age. But surely today, okay, we want to keep the Russians out. It looks highly unlikely to my eye when I'm in a depressed mood that we can keep the Americans in. And we most certainly don't want to keep the Germans down. Would you agree with that?
It depends who you're talking to. The Brits are still... It's funny, as soon as Scholz did his Zeitenwende speech, his epochal-changing speech 3 days after Putin's invasion, and promised that Germany would spend 2% on defense and it would do a one-off injection of 100 billion euros to sort out its absolutely ailing armed forces, one of the responses in amongst the praise for him and for his bravery was, oh, where does that leave Britain as the dominant military force? And already, I mean, in the last week, the Germans and the Americans were the first to follow the French in sending or promising to send armored personnel carriers to Ukraine, which is not enough. It's not what the Ukrainians need enough of, but it's an improvement on where we were before. So Germany is moving, and in a way, we want Germany to be an active, or certainly I do, and others do. They want Germany to be a big player now, finally, in European security, but they almost don't want it to become too big, I think would be a British response and possibly also a French response as well. But I'm not sure, actually, now the point about just saying it's not going to happen anymore, that the Americans are going to disengage. I think in some respects, Putin has been one of the several inadvertent consequences of Putin's invasion has been to strengthen the transatlantic ties. I mean, Macron declared only a few months before that NATO was brain dead and that European defense needed to be created without the Americans. That's not going to happen. That the Americans' attention was only on the Indo-Pacific, in other words, Asia and China. Yes. America had given up on Europe. I don't think that's happening now in the way it was. I think Europe has returned, if not center stage, then equal stage with what's going on with China and around there.
What will happen, John, if this new House of Representatives, the Congress, with this weak leader, Kevin McCarthy, and the people who control that House now are basically election deniers, they're Trump followers. They are extreme, beyond extreme. They will be able to control to some extent the supply of arms and money, money in particular, to Ukraine. Now, you point out in the piece that you wrote for the New European that Zelensky went there and put as much pressure as he could on the Biden administration. He didn't get anything like everything he wanted. He got, but he got stuff. Now, if America, through a malfunctioning Congress, cannot supply the arms and the money, first of all, to help Ukraine in its present conflict with Russia, but also to rebuild Ukraine and make it part of the Western family, as it were, where do we go from there if America takes that turn?
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways of looking at that. I mean, when you go back to the midterm elections in at the start of November, the assumption then was going to be a landslide for the Republicans. And by that, we meant Trumpian Republicans. Now, that did not happen.
Yes.
They scraped through in the House of Representatives, and they failed to take the Senate. Now, a couple of weeks before those elections, if you had said to any American liberal or Democrat that this would be the result, they would have bitten your arm off. They would have been absolutely relieved at such an outcome. So, yes, and you know, it is one of those midterm elections in which the sitting president's party has suffered the least in recent years and recent decades. It's absolutely axiomatic. And it's a failing of the American system that basically the president has 2 years. And pretty much every president has had 2 years before Congress is hamstrung by the other party gaining a significant foothold in it. So the Republicans, yeah, are far stronger than they were, but they're much, much less strong than they wanted to be. And also, yeah, I mean, it depends how right-wing you think right-wing is, but Trump himself did not do well. His candidates did worse than the average Republican candidates. A lot of Trump's backers, like Rupert Murdoch and others, are bailing from him. Lots of people on the Republican side are talking about Ron DeSantis and others as potential presidential candidates. So it's a more nuanced, it's a more complicated picture than that. Yeah, there are a significant group of headbangers, and they were the ones who stopped 15 rounds worth of voting to make sure that McCarthy didn't become speaker, and then eventually...
But he gave them everything, John, including... He gave them everything. There were only a handful of them, and he's given them everything, including the power...
To get rid of him.
Yeah, one person. Only one person required to put him under pressure. Yeah. So clearly it won't function very well, and extremists are in effective control because they're not really interested in governing. What they want to do is disrupt the prevailing rules of engagement. Let me ask you again.
Yeah, so I mean, on that, Eamon, in governance terms, America is heading for another bad period, but there haven't been many periods when it's had great governance in recent years. But in political terms, it will not have gone unnoticed by floating voters that the Republican Party is an absolute shower at the moment. I mean, not to be able to come up with the most important parliamentary position and for the whole thing to descend into days of chaos is not a good look for the Republicans. A party split, people almost exchanging punches, that kind of thing. So for the Democrats, again, if you're just being cynical, it's not a bad outcome.
Let me ask you again the question that you posed at the top of your piece. Where does Europe go from here? The possibility that America may turn to isolationism, that the MAGA Republicans make America great again, which of course involves not doling out money to save Ukraine or anywhere else for that matter. Does Europe face some hard choices in terms of whether it has an army, whether it has the deterrence to deter Russia, whether it can afford to whip Orban and the new Czech leader who is a Russian, who's expected to win the Czech.
No, he's not expected to win, actually. I don't think Babiš will win. In fact, I've just written a piece about him for next week's New European. It's up in the air on that. It's really important, though, the Czech elections coming up, the first round's coming up in a few days' time.
Yes, and the point I want to make, or I'm trying to make, is that it feels, I don't know where Europe is in the power play. If this is a moment where we're seeing a war between democracies, law-abiding countries, and authoritarians, and not just Russia and China, but Iran, the Saudis, and people like that, are we at a point where Europe needs to look at the world and see what its place is to protect Europe?
It's such an important question that you raise, Eamon, and there's no simple answer to it. In fact, the British Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, gave quite an interesting speech just before Christmas talking about all of this and pointing out, and in this respect, I think he's right, saying that we have to be smarter about this zero-sum goodies versus baddies, democracies versus dictatorship, because the world in some ways has moved on. And I've been for some time now obsessed by this idea of pivot states, you know, the countries that are not particularly, to coin a phrase, our cup of tea, but at the same time are broadly aligned with what we in the West and are trying to do. Now, you could say that's cynical and you can only go for countries who are sort of squeaky clean in all respects. But then your source of alliances gets ever more diminishing. And in the global South in particular, China is wooing countries, but its attractions are limited. So I think the West has got to rethink the way it does things. But when it comes to Russia and Ukraine, you can look at this as half empty or half full. And some days I look at it in one, and some ways I look at it in the other. The half empty is Europe is at breaking point, public discontent over cost of living, gas prices, and that situation is only going to get worse next year. Next winter, people focusing so much on this winter, actually wait till next November, December. I think it's going to get even harder. And, you know, something's going to crack and public support for helping Ukraine will wane and governments will therefore start to rein that back and all that. Meantime, Putin plays a waiting game and it's an attritional war and he doesn't win, but he doesn't do as badly as some people thought. That's what one argument. The other more optimistic argument, which I sometimes feel, sometimes I don't feel, is that actually democracy was, when you look at Brexit, Trump, Marine Le Pen, everything else, a few years ago, we thought it was dead.
Yes.
We thought it was absolutely over. And the new era was China, and a bit of Russia, and along with global money and corruption, everything else. And actually, it's proving reasonably resilient. So I think if you're looking at the next 5 or 10 years, I think the most likely outcome is going to be somewhere in the middle. It's going to be messy. Ukraine is going to be frustrated at a lack of support, but the support is still one hell of a lot better than anybody. Everybody just assumed Putin would walk in within 4 or 5 days. He'd get to Kiev and he'd install some puppet and that would be the end. And it's been absolutely not like that. And that's a great testament, not just to Ukraine and Ukrainians, but actually to democracy.
Okay, John, we're very grateful to you for joining us. I should say that the piece I'm referring to is in a publication called The New European. We're grateful to you for joining us. And that's John Kampfner. John is a very distinguished journalist and broadcaster. And his latest book, Why the Germans Do It Better, Notes from a Grown-Up Country. He's writing another book about Berlin. So thank you very much, John.
Thanks, Eamon.
Good luck with your book. We're grateful to John, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.